Sometimes I go over to.
Greetings and good day. I welcome you to the making of the John Batchelor Show. I am he. The news around the world is grim. The war fighting in the Strait of Hormuz, the war fighting in Ukraine, the confrontation throughout Africa from east to west, reporting yesterday, and I hope to get that report contained on the fighting in Somalia, where we've been fighting for, it feels like, 40 years. Somalia is a desperate land. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Russia, China, all the bad players plus Turkey. However, we're turning to a potentially very grim situation, which is East Asia, and the ambitions of the People's Republic of China to annex, grab, conquer Taiwan. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, joins me as my colleague and co-host, and we're very pleased to welcome our colleague, Steve Yates of the Heritage Foundation, to comment on the news. This is the South China Morning Post, which is a daily in English, but it is presumed to be influenced by the Chinese Communist Party. The headline, Taiwan's opposition launches historic first trip to mainland China, subhead. The party aims to build goodwill to promote dialogue while supporting cross-strait activities. I stop there because all that needs translation. Steve, a very good day to you. Historic first trip. What is the game here? What is the subtext to the word historic? Good evening to you.
Thank you, John. Well, this part of the opposition is the minor coalition partner with the nationalist Kuomintang. Of course, famously, the leader of the Kuomintang did go visit with Xi Jinping before coming to Washington, D.C. to try to consult with U.S. officials. This TPP, not to be confused with the DPP, that is the ruling party, but this new power party was basically an offshoot of the DPP originally. And after losing some of its key figures, it migrated into a coalition that bandwagoned away from the DPP to give the KMT the governing majority in the legislative UN. And so what used to be a very pro-independence, very pro-Taiwan youth movement on the green side of politics is now kind of a power player as a minority coalition partner. So that's part of why it's historic. It's this evolution of this youth Taiwan identity movement, kind of a populist movement, into now being part of this broader coalition that is exploring cross-strait ties. And so it's part of, obviously, you can't really blame the mainland for desiring to reach out, engage, divide, and conquer. But I think it's not going to be met with good reception in Taiwan. I don't think the KMT chair's visit to China was well received, broadly speaking, in Taiwan. I don't think this is going to help this minority coalition partner.
Wonderful. All right. We'll begin immediately then. I understand now. I didn't know. I was thrown by the idea of opposition. Isn't that Kuomintang? So now I understand there's a breakaway. Is it considered a populist party? Does that word apply in Taiwan?
In its origins, I think it would fit into that category because basically you had the protest movements that grew from what's called the Sunflower Movement. They were protesting things like the Ma administration's broad trade framework that it was selling for cross-strait relations. They protested a few different laws that would have kind of changed a sense of identity and sovereignty for Taiwan. They were part of the demonstrations that took over the legislative yuan And the former leader of the legislative yuan got relented after many, many days and met with the youth. And they finally got the legislature open, and the cross-strait trade pact was blocked. And so it was out of that kind of populist demonstration. It wasn't as ideological as normal politics might be. And I think that lack of cohesive ideology for this small party is kind of how we end up with this fraying to this migration. But its current leader, Huang Guoqiang, has achieved a degree of power and influence as a broker to tip the balance in the legislature. And I think he's just using this to build out a national platform. I don't like his chances in that, but I think that's the game.
Good. We've got a lot to do in 9 minutes. Here we go, gentlemen. Thank you. Gordon, I'm going to come right to you. Five, about the Taiwan third party. Five, four. Everybody hear everything easily? Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Two, one. I'm John Batster, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host, and we're going to the island of Taiwan for an interpretation. There's an historic visit underway on the mainland by a political unit called the TPP. We welcome our friend Steve Yates of the Heritage Foundation to understand, because my years of reporting on Taiwan, thanks to these gentlemen, has always regarded the Kuomintang as the opposition. This is new to me. Steve, a very good day to you. What is the TPP? And there's suggestion here that it has elements of a populist party, which would put Taiwan consistent with other populist parties, say, in Germany or in France or in America. Is that what it is? And why historic visit? Good evening to you.
Well, thank you, John. This is where Taiwan is the gift that keeps on giving, in that it has a lot of things that would sound familiar when we talk about the pieces, but the way they mix together in Taiwan is a bit different than you might imagine at first blush. The TPP in its origins was a youth movement in Taiwan. It was more on the green or pro-independence side of the Taiwan political spectrum, or more, I guess, more accurate to say, Taiwan identity. Part of the political spectrum. There was a broad trade agreement that the KMT Ma administration had put forward for cross-strait relations, and they were in opposition to moving forward with this pact. They saw it as an erosion of identity, erosion of their economic and political future. And so they had organized in ways that actually took over the legislative yuan in Taiwan, blocked business, went for several days. It was largely a peaceful demonstration, though the police did push back from time to time on the demonstrators. Ultimately, that time, Wang Jinping was the KMT head of the legislative yuan. He met with the leaders of this student movement, kind of became Sunflower Movement, and they relented, and the legislature turned back the trade pact that the Ma administration had put forward, and this sort of offshoot of what was the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, was born. It was a separate party. Many of its members really had been aligned with the DPP, but not all of them. And so it was populist in a sense that it didn't fit perfectly into the round hole or the square hole of the two parties in Taiwan. Its leadership frayed over time. And then what we ended up with was them playing a coalition role with the KMT to tip the balance, to give a governing majority to the KMT to run in opposition to the Democratic Progressive ruling party under current politics. So because they were a youth movement, because they were very Taiwan identity oriented in their outset, they didn't have this engagement with China on their radar. And that's why I think it's being listed as historic, because of the origins of this party, its evolution from support for the DPP and coalition there to support for the KMT and coalition there, and its leader, Huang Guoqiang, looking at carving out his own identity, perhaps to be a candidate in the upcoming presidential election. Who knows?
Gordon, you have a question.
Steve, the TPP is aligned with the Kuomintang, the ruling, the party that has the control of the legislature. The Kuomintang is generally described as pro-China. It's the China party in Taiwan. Those people who identify as Chinese are generally in the Kuomintang. If you look at self-identification surveys, especially in the 16 to 24 age cohort, overwhelmingly they identify as Taiwanese. The last one that I saw, 83% in that group saw themselves as Taiwanese, not Chinese. So how does the TPP sort of manage this divide in identity by allying with the pro-China party?
Well, this is where politics does things to people, where the pursuit of power and influence causes some to compromise what the identity of their movement was in order to have a seat at the table. And I don't think that the broad base, whatever the definition of a broad base for the TPP would be any different than what you described in terms of do they identify as Chinese or Taiwanese. And I think that what the leadership might say by way of justification is, in order to be a responsible governing party in Taiwan, apart from the identity issues, we have to find ways to talk with and negotiate with the other side of the strait. That's been an enduring theme of conversation in Taiwan. I don't necessarily follow that ethos because I don't know that I always need to talk to another entity who has as a declared mission my execution. And that is, I think there's no bones about the way the Communist Party of China talks about Taiwan. It's already theirs. And especially with this new law passed on the mainland where they outlaw talking about this separate identity, it really puts the TPP, given its origins, in a very odd position. So I see this only as a move to try to acquire power and a platform from which to run in Taiwan, under an assumption that the DPP might be weakened to the point where there's a split vote and there's an opportunity to run a threading of the needle in the middle. But that's the best I could put on this. I generally don't see the odds of success for this kind of engagement or this kind of movement as very, very high.
Is there an organizing around age? In other words, are we looking at millennials or Gen Z? I'm thinking of the Mamdani model in New York. Populism can be based upon the charisma of a leader. How old is the leader? What do we know about the leadership of the TPP?
Well, it's generally young. And so, I mean, if you look at the average age of especially the elected leaderships of different parties, the TPP would be decidedly younger than the elected leadership of the KMT and the DPP. It's because it was a youth movement. Now, one of its original leaders was a very, very good friend named Freddie Lim, who now represents Taiwan in Finland. And he has the immense curse of looking 20 years younger than he actually is. And so he looked like a youth leader. He was the front man for a screaming metal group, so he's very popular among young people. But he might have been closer to my age than the young people when he was actually active in politics. Huang Guoqiang, I think, is younger than Freddie. But probably older than the average age of the TPP. The difference, I think, is if you're going to have a populist movement, you have to be engaging in themes that are verifiably popular among that younger demographic. And it's not about truth or falsehood. It's what do they really believe and what mobilizes them. And I don't see a groundswell among the youth of Taiwan to say, I'd like to have a new trade pact with China. I'd like to have more Chinese tourists in Taiwan. I'd like to break a new path. I think they've seen the military exercises, the isolation, the constant demagoguery, and then passing a law that has made it so that they can't be ordinary tourists as easily. They can't go to school the way some of their cohort had tried to before. I mean, there's a huge drop off in young people going across the strait, just like there's been a huge drop off in investment from Taiwan into China.
Steve Yates of the Heritage Foundation helping us understand the proverb, young men die in old men's wars. If it's a populist party, it'll show itself. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. I think it's an exciting development.
Definitely interesting.
It would annoy both the DPP and the Kuomintang.
Well, definitely when they stand out on their own. Now, they've tried to do that with the arms package debate in the legislature. I think that's another litmus test for this model and their leadership and sort of the muddle that that rested in. I don't think it speaks well for any of the parties, but I think the DPP comes out looking better in that it was committed to indigenous development, which is something the United States and Japan and others had wanted Taiwan to do. And so even in a loss, the DPP ended up looking better. But the TPP tried to distinguish itself from the KMT in that. And I don't know how well that came across.
To be continued.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Take good care.
Good morning. And we move immediately to Cleo.
Morning.
Just
Good
yesterday,
clear.
I was talking to the garden, and I said, "Where in the world is Cleo Pascal?" The garden had no answer, and Gordon and Lydia did have an answer. Where in the world is Cleo Pascal? Especially because China fired a ballistic missile towards the Fiji Solomon area. I thought maybe Cleo's behind this.
They missed me. I was on the mainland, so I'm in the DC area. I was enjoying the pleasures of the celebrations around the 4th of July, which were really quite wonderful around here. So
Oh,
that's what I
there,
was doing.
I had you on the beach, the last hangout on Palau as the Chinese invade. I take back my idea. Okay.
Not totally wrong, because I'm just back from a trip to Guam, Yap, Palau, and Taiwan. So,
Was the noise about the missile loud in Palau, the Marianas, and Marshall? Did they note it?
yes, I mean, it depends on the country. So, Palau, Marshalls, and Tuvalu are all countries that recognize Taiwan. So they were all, and it landed near Tuvalu, if not in Tuvaluan waters. So they definitely noticed. It's for me, it's a question of the dogs that didn't bark, who didn't say anything. Those are the countries I'm worried about. And Kiribati didn't say anything. The current government in Kiribati didn't say anything, which is that I could see, which is concerning.
Final question on it. Was it purposeful or did it just get away from China?
It looked to me very purposeful. It went over. It went through U.S. territories in between two U.S. freely associated states, and then landed near the waters of a country that recognizes Taiwan.
Okay.
So yeah, but and actually, I heard Victor Gao say something in one of his interviews, which was interesting because he was asked whether the timing was about the by an Australian journalist, whether it was about Australia's deal with Fiji, as if Australia is the center of the universe, and he said no, it was the day after or before the Imperial Japanese War of Aggression against China. Which is interesting because in that context, what he was also saying was countries that don't have nuclear weapons don't have anything to worry about from Chinese nuclear weapons. So he was at least presenting it in part as a threat to Japan to not go nuclear.
Okay.
Does that,
Wonderful.
if that makes sense, Gordon?
It does make sense. We're going to Solomon's, right, Gordon? We're going to stay with the Solomon's.
We're going to talk about Cleo's
Right, I've got it in front of me. Right.
piece about the coordination of the propaganda.
And Cleo, did I misread that the Solomon's had flipped back?
So they have a new government that is trying to. I prefer to think of it as countries where the leadership are trying to exert the sovereignty of their country versus countries where the leadership are proxies of China.
Okay. I'll ask you. Here we go. This is 8 to 9 minutes for tonight, Cleo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, and we go immediately to concerns of the Solomon Islands. Read this as Guadalcanal and its friends. Recent history has been too much turmoil to summarize, other than to say that the Solomons have been in play. Now we turn to Cleo Pascal, our colleague at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, to understand the present state of the Solomon Islands, choosing between the People's Republic of China, and everybody else, including the United States and Taiwan. That's the choice here of for a series of islands north of Australia. The headline in the Sunday Guardian, that's India, a smoking gun in the Solomons proves information shaping by China. Cleo, a very good day to you. Information shaping, what is that, and why is it at play in the Solomon Islands? I've missed a few chapters here. Good evening to you, Cleo.
Good evening. So that's a headline that is constrained by space. It should actually be cognitive warfare domain, so which is a little bit too long and even more difficult to explain. But this is something that the Chinese Communist Party and Xi himself has spoken about being one of the most important elements of domain. There's a quote in there about how you have to break down the mental defenses before you can break down the physical defenses, or it makes breaking down the physical defenses easier. And it's part of the whole political warfare thing. It's everything left of bang before you start shooting things. But this is specifically getting into people's heads. You rarely get a kind of smoking gun on the political warfare battlefield, but we did in this case, because the exact same article, including the same headline, appeared in two different Solomon Islands newspapers on exactly the same day. The only difference was the name of the author. They had each article had a different author attributed to it, a kind of generic Englishy name, like, I don't know, William Crawley or something like that. And they were both identified as being from Australia. And the articles, the content of the article was why the country of Palau, which recognizes Taiwan and is about to host a very important regional meeting, the Pacific Island Forum Leaders meeting at the end of August, should not recognize Taiwan anymore. So very clearly in keeping with Chinese narrative warfare. So how did this happen? It just so happens, I know the editor of one of the two newspapers and got in touch with him. He hadn't actually even been aware that this was going on. He was, I think he was out of the country, but he tracked it down. And the article had come in via WhatsApp to another junior editor who had just posted it, because the newspapers and the news sites everywhere, but especially in the region, often are just looking for content, and especially content about the region. And people who are trying to shape the narrative know that. And so they pump out disinformation or narrative warfare, whatever you want to call it, lies into those newspapers, knowing that they don't have the editorial staff to be able to check it. And then from there, larger newspapers report on that, and then it starts to amplify. And if they're lucky, it gets into the AI feeds and it becomes part of kind of the semi-official shaping narrative of what's going on. So they had never met this journalist, the so-called journalist. They had never spoken to the person. They didn't know if he actually even existed, but it went in. And the same I've heard, but not firsthand, was true of the other paper. So it's a very clear case, I think, of narrative warfare, of cognitive domain warfare. And it's helpful because it tells us what they want, which is how important the Pacific Island Forum meeting in a country that recognizes Taiwan is to China, how far they'll go to derail it. I think this is just the first of many. The article contains a threat for countries that continue to recognize Taiwan. It's a useful smoking gun. It's got fingerprints all over it, and we know the direction they're shooting now.
Detective Cleo, wonderful. Gordon, you have a question for Detective Cleo.
Detective Cleo, what do you think Beijing will do next to derail that meeting about the Pacific Forum?
So I think they're doing multiple things already at the same time. I've heard that there are in-person high-level threats from Chinese officials to Palauan officials and relatives of officials. This is secondhand, but there was a kerfuffle between a Chinese government representative and the president of Palau in Fiji, where again threats were made. Relatives of high-ranking Palauan official was threatened with, economic. He has a business that does business in China, and threats were made about his ability to continue to do that. So I think there'll be all the usual stuff you would expect, like cyber. When Palau signed, it renewed its compact of free association with the U.S., there was a major cyber attack on one of its government ministries on the same day. So there'll be all of that, but they will be that. The Chinese will be on the ground. And what they've already done in Palau, just to give you an idea, this is a country of about 18,000 people of incredible principle and courage and strength, just the other side of the Philippines. So if China can flip Palau, they can squeeze the Philippines from both sides. What China did was pump up the tourism sector. This was between 2012 and 2015, 2016, until China was by far the dominant. Over 100,000 Chinese tourists were coming a year. And then they pulled all the tourists in order to exert pressure on Palau overtly to derecognize Taiwan. They built up a whole industry, a whole economy around the industry, and then destroyed the industry in order to exert economic pressure. And the Palauans still didn't flip. And so what they did next, and it is very interesting, which is they started sending in high-level triad operators to do entropic warfare, to fragment and disintegrate the society. And that includes people like Broken Tooth. Palau has an increasing meth problem. Prince Group was operating through Palau, again, country of 18,000 people. And so they've been pushing back on that as much as they can. They've been kicking bad actors out of the country. But the U.S. State Department designated the president of the Senate of Palau for taking Chinese money. But they didn't give the case files to the attorney general in Palau, so she can't prosecute them, which means that you've got a guy that the State Department says is corrupt as president of the Senate. He hates the U.S. because he can no longer travel to the U.S., nor can his family. And Guam is right next door, so that's a real problem.
30 seconds.
Yeah, but they can't prosecute him. So these attacks are coming from all directions. And one of the latest ones is the Chinese have now offered Palau, oh, you've got a Chinese illegal problem. Why don't we send our police to come and help you with it? So it's coming from all directions at this little country, and they urgently need a political warfare rapid response team to push back before the Pacific Island Forum meeting at the end of August.
Cleo Pascal, a senior fellow for the Foundation for Defensive Democracy, alerting everyone there's information warfare in the Indo-Pacific and China's on the march. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. Well done, Detective Cleo. Well done.
I need my deer stalker.
I mentioned to you that what I know to be true is that when I have a problem with a piece of software or I want information, Claudette offers to write the letter for me and can immediately. The reason I tell that story is that journalist could be AI. It
definitely could be. And he's written, whoever has written two more in the other newspaper, which is a newspaper that's on the record as taking money from China, on similar topics. So it's definitely possible. But we know, just from the other two articles also, it's very clear what's going on.
Yes, I know. It's just that we've often wondered about copyright and AI. This is the dark side of AI.
My sense is also it was probably originally written in Mandarin, just by the phrasing and things like that. So it may also have been generated even in AI and then translated.
Thank you.
But it does look AI-y.
Thank you, Cleo. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Cleo.
And Mr. Burton is here. We march immediately to everything's working this morning. I'm feeling powerful here. What? Look at this. The last time I started pushing buttons, everything blew up. I lost everybody. But now, if I just stay away from my prompt, apparently it's safer. Good morning to you,
Good morning. Good morning. Well, a good show you've had today, Steve Yates and Cleo.
I've been reading about Benedict Arnold's invasion of Canada in 1771 up the Kennebec River, thinking of time travel, Charles, invaded by Benedict Arnold. You know, that's a rough beginning for a country.
Yeah, so I mean, Benjamin Franklin spent quite a long period in Quebec City trying to convince the Canadians to join the United States. It didn't seem to work. I don't know why.
Arnold gave a speech to his men, you know, because they were tromping through the Kennebec River Valley and they were extremely hungry. And these are tough guys, you know, frontiersmen. They were called the riflemen of Pennsylvania. The long carbines, every one of them a model of Natty Bumppo, and they're starving to death. So he gives this patriotic speech about how we're going to free Canada from the crown and bring in our brethren from the north and make us one great big continent. Inspirational speech to get them to push on.
It's very much like China with regard to Taiwan.
It worked out in the right way, I think. So.
No, I mean, the War of 1812.
All right.
Also different. It's sort of like the bridge, different interpretations on both sides. Everybody won.
Yes.
Or didn't lose.
Now, this morning we have two different issues. Well, sort of in the same direction. Canada's efforts to convince Canadian politicians that they're not China or that they're not malevolent China simultaneously.
Right.
That's been underway for some time.
Certainly making much more success nowadays.
I'll open with the bridge open. It is open now, right? Gordy knows.
It opens on the 27th.
Gordon, okay to start with the bridge because it's got a great name. Gordy Howe Bridge.
It's a really interesting story.
Yeah, it certainly is. A bridge over troubled water. This would be a river under troubled bridge, I guess, to reverse the Simon and Garfunkel line. All right. Yeah. Dating myself, Charles. I can't help it.
Oh, I don't know. Doesn't seem that long ago to me, although Art Garfunkel really can't sing anymore.
I was unaware that where they are. I wish them well. It was a very big moment. In the, I guess it was the 60s. Yeah, the 60s. All right, here we go. The Gordie Howe Bridge.
1970 for that record. Yeah.
The Gordie Howe Bridge. And then we'll move to politicians vulnerable to influence peddling. Five. This is two segments, Charles, so we don't have to rush it. Four,
okay.
Three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. The Gordie Howe Bridge, is it open? Is it going to open? What is the controversy here? A bridge over a river between two countries that are completely comfortable with each other, no border barriers, no reason to worry about the future. However, we welcome Charles Burton of the Synopsis Institute, the author of The Beaver and the Dragon, the story of the relationship so far between China and Canada. But the Gordie Howe Bridge is more than China. It's also the nature of Canada dealing with the world around it, including the United States of America. Charles, a very good day to you. I've lost entirely the track on the Gordie Howe Bridge. It's got a terrific name, and it looks good. Is it open? Good day to you, Charles.
The bridge is almost open. The official opening will now be on the 27th of July, and a lot of good feelings about this bridge, because the Ambassador Bridge, which is a U.S. privately owned bridge built in 1929, is really no longer fit to purpose. There are long lines for the trucks going over, inadequate customs facilities. It's got potholes. And to get from the Canadian highway to the U.S. highway, you have to go through 10 traffic lights. The new bridge will connect directly from one superhighway to another and has modern customs facilities and will not incur delay. And is promised to have a much lower toll than the original tolls on the privately owned Ambassador Bridge. So it's all good news if you're a trucker wanting to move between the United States and Canada. But the owners of the Ambassador Bridge, the Maroon family, are not happy about this new bridge.
The bridge is between Windsor, Ontario, and Detroit, Michigan. And I'm presuming everybody in Windsor, everybody in Detroit wants the bridge to open. So why? Why hasn't it opened? What is an unhappy family can keep a bridge from opening?
Well, an unhappy family that made a $1 million donation to a MAGA foundation and has close connections with Mr. Lutnick. So the terms of the bridge were originally that both sides should share in the cost of the bridge, but the Maroon family opposed that, and therefore Michigan wasn't able to allocate its share in the bridge. So the $6.4 billion for the construction of this bridge was assumed entirely by the Canadian side, expecting that the money would be reimbursed over 30 years from the tolls. Subsequently, Mr. Trump suggested that this was an unfair deal and the bridge would not open, that the U.S. should have ownership of the bridge. In fact, Canada and the U.S. share ownership of the bridge. It's simply that the money allocated to build a bridge would be paid out of the tolls. And then once the $6.4 billion was reimbursed, then the tolls would be shared equally. So Mr. Trump said the bridge can't open until we've resolved this issue. And the resolution has occurred, and Mr. Trump has announced a victory that the United States has successfully, coerced Canada into changing the terms of the original deal whereby Canada would pay for the bridge and then would be paid back over 30 years. That the United States over the first 15 years would take 50% of revenue to pay for development projects on the Detroit side. Detroit, as you probably know, is not in good economic shape compared to Windsor. So Mr. Trump was able to declare victory in terms of asserting U.S. interests, but then the Canadian Prime Minister said that. No, this isn't indicative of bad negotiation on our part and not indicative of how the negotiations on the free trade will proceed, because what he negotiated was 50% of the net profit from the tolls over the next 15 years. And Mr. Carney said that he presumed that there really wouldn't be any net profit over the next 15 years. And so while this commitment has been made, very little money will be transferred in terms of this agreement. So you see two stories on the negotiation with regard to changing the U.S. decision to refuse to allow the bridge to open. And also, but there are some terms with regard to tolls that are still rather hazy. And the question is, the Maroon family does not want the tolls on the Gordie Howe Bridge to be significantly lower than the tolls they're charging on the Ambassador Bridge. And so there may be some resolution there. The details of it really haven't been fully released, and we're just relying on what the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Canada have said. And the two stories are quite different in terms of Canadian concessions.
Gordon, you have a question.
Charles, when I was in Detroit a couple months ago, I could see the Gordie Howe Bridge all lit up. Beautiful, but of course no traffic. How long has the bridge been able to bear traffic and been closed because of this dispute?
It was originally supposed to open in 2024, and then there were construction delays. So I think we've been looking at just a matter of months, not years in this delay. I think that the donation by the Maroon family was maybe 6 or 8 months ago. So it's not been an enormous loss, but 25% of the trade from the United States into Canada passes over this single bridge.
So, Charles, are Are people in Ottawa or people in Canada in general upset about the way the Trump administration has dealt with the bridge?
Oh, yes. It's a very serious issue and has caused great discontent with regard to Canada-U.S. relations, particularly with the upcoming negotiations on free trade. And of course, it does increase the Canadian population's will to see Canada move more closely to China and try and reduce the dependence of Canada economically on the United States. But this is a fantasy because presently Canada only does 4% of its external commodity trade to China. It's more like 75% with the United States. We have to come up with some way to resolve these difficulties with the United States, not to speak of the 35 U.S. states whose major trading partner is Canada, who provide a lot into the Canadian economy. I think that's one of the reasons the Prime Minister made his speech suggesting that Canada not made a lot of concessions with regard to the bridge, because the way that Mr. Trump's depicting it has gone over like a lead balloon in Canada, and the degree of hostility of Canadians towards the United States is proceeding apace and without much sign of resolution. The American ambassador in Ottawa has been more conciliatory than he has been in the past, because I think it's becoming apparent in Washington that they do have a problem with Canada if Canadians are prepared to undergo significant economic sacrifices to make a point, that they feel that we've been shafted by the U.S. with regard to non-compliance with the terms of the free trade agreement, the imposition of tariffs and of course the president's disrespectful statements about Canadian national sovereignty and the leadership of Canada, which, you know, some people take very seriously.
So the wounding I thought was healing is not healing, Charles? Is that too much?
We have observed a slight increase in the number of Canadians traveling to the United States. There have been, you know, something of a boycott of people going down there, which has had quite a negative impact on, say, the economy of Florida. The ban on import of U.S. alcohol, it's illegal for me to purchase or acquire any U.S. wine or spirits here in Ontario, will not be, is very unlikely to be taken off despite the demands of the Americans, simply because it's considered a principled stance of expressing discontent and seems to enjoy the support of the vast, vast majority of Canadians of all political stripes.
Charles Burton of the Synopsis Institute giving us to understand that the Gordie Howe Bridge is not a bridge between the two nations, the opposite. But we're going to move to a more difficult subject, which is the authority of China in Canada. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague and friend Gordon Chang, and we're visiting with Charles Burton, our colleague at the Synopsis Institute in Ottawa, looking at a headline written for a card article by Charles Burton in the Globe and Mail. That's the number one paper in Canada. How many more times will Beijing fool Canada's politicians? Charles, your remarks summarize years of questions unanswered about China's influence peddling in Canada. The new prime minister is aware of all of these details. Is he addressing the matter directly to the parliament or to the people of Canada?
The short answer to that question is no. He's not very responsive to parliament. He seems to see himself as the CEO of the country. He doesn't attend question period very often, and he doesn't seem to be taking parliamentary committees very seriously. And in general, his advisors are no longer cabinet ministers, members of parliament, but important and successful figures in finance and business who are taking up key positions in the prime minister's office. So The disrespect for democratic institutions under Mr. Carney continues apace. So I don't think that he's been responsive to this at all. But what we're seeing is a great increase in the amount of Canadian elite business engagement with China, including Mr. Carney's own company, Brookfield Asset Management. And we're seeing enormous concessions being made to the Chinese regime on the promise of increased trade to diversify Canada's economic dependence away from the U.S. At least that's the way it's depicted, although practically speaking, I don't think that's the way it's going to happen. The idea that China would import a large quantity of Canadian commodities into the PRC at a time when its economy is failing and its mercantilistic policies are based on exports is extremely unlikely, in my view, although the Chinese foreign minister did suggest that if Canada was compliant with his demand that we set aside differences and seek common ground, that Canada could double its trade by the 2050. But as I point out in my article, we had similar promises from Hu Jintao to double trade within 5 years in 2005. And then in 2016, the Premier Li Keqiang promised to double trade by 2025. It's never happened. And so there does seem to be a gap between the rhetoric and the reality that all the concessions being made to China will likely benefit a small number of Canadian businesses that have close associations with Chinese communist business networks, but will not actually lead to promoting significant Canadian employment prosperity in the wake of the economic downturn engendered by the Trump tariffs and the Trump reshoring of the auto sector policies.
Gordon, you have a comment and question for Charles.
The comment is that just a few hours ago, the China's National Bureau of Statistics reported that the Chinese economy grew only 4.3% in the second quarter, well below already diminished expectations, which is really quite stunning. I actually think 4.3 is above what the actual performance was, but it shows a new level of candor in Beijing. I wonder if the corporate executives in Canada have really noticed the downturn in the Chinese economy and the effect that will have on Beijing's promises to increase trade. Because it seems like China may not have the ability to actually go forward on that promise.
Oh, I quite agree. I don't think there's ever been any intention on the part of China to significantly increase trade. It's all promises and unrealized benefits. I mean, this has been the consistent approach, and Canadian government after Canadian government have been dazzled by the idea of enormous increases in trade. But the terms of that are that Canada should not do anything that will cause Beijing to dampen its expansion, infiltration into Canada. So, you know, we've already had threats, I guess, by the Chinese ambassador that Canada should cease to allow parliamentarians to visit Taiwan, should cease the freedom of navigation exercises in the Taiwan Strait, should repudiate the Indo-Pacific policy, which defines China as a disruptive power. At the time, I thought that was rather weak. I thought strategic competitor, strategic adversary would have been more to the mark. And that we shouldn't be expelling any Chinese diplomats or engaging in the foreign influence registry that would reveal Chinese proxies in Canada. And the latest has been Canada's adopting of legislation to strengthen the restrictions on the import of forced labor, slave labor into Canada. And the Chinese want an exemption for the Uyghur and Tibetan territories, which, of course, is the main point, particularly in terms of forced labor. The Uyghur areas are the biggest ones and are using a series of seven commissions that have been established to negotiate Canada-China relations across all aspects, which, because of the asymmetrical nature of Canada-China relations, would favor Chinese interests. So, you know, Canada's making an enormous number of concessions in the non-trade area for a promise of expanded trade that's being played to the Canadian people, that China will be our salvation from the ravages of the Trump policies. But in fact, China will not be our salvation, but it will benefit a small number of Canadian industries and services that have traditionally had relations with China and that have significant influence in the center of Ottawa, the Prime Minister's office.
Charles, pardon my suspiciousness. The Trudeau government left questions unanswered about Chinese influence in Canada and in the Prime Minister's office. Now there are questions that can be asked but not answered about Chinese influence in the majority Liberal Party again, and with the Prime Minister not concerned in any fashion we can tell from Chinese penetration campaigns. Is there a problem in the Liberal Party that needs to be investigated? We have about a minute.
Yes, I would say that we do need more knowledge of conflict of interest at the seat of power, and we're not getting that. Mr. Carney's attitude is that we have to accept the world as it is, and therefore we should trade with China and accept all of the other aspects, which really include things that threaten Canadian sovereignty, such as espionage and influence operations, transnational repression, and so on. That he doesn't seem to think that there's any need to be concerned about this if we can get more business going with China in years ahead. Right now, he's in Saudi Arabia negotiating some business deals, so, along with what he did with Qatar. So we do seem to be dealing with some fairly unsavory regimes with the interest giving Canadians the impression that the Prime Minister is doing something significant to counter Mr. Trump's policies towards Canada.
And it's okay with the Liberal Party base. 30 seconds.
Yes, and I mean, I noticed in the comments in my article in the Globe and Mail, in the online edition, that most people evidently don't think what I said matters, and that the importance is diversification of trade and more engagement with China. I was very disappointed to see those kinds of comments. How representative they are of the readership, hard to say, but you know, it's an awful lot of we need to do more with China.
Charles Burton, Gordon Chang, the articles in the Globe and Mail as of this week. I'm John Batchelor. Yeah, you got a problem, Charles.
We have a huge problem. I mean, it's never been this bad through my whole career, and my career's gone on for a long time.
I would say the problem goes around to Washington, too. Gordon, have you come across conversations, anybody in Washington worry about China penetration of Canada?
I haven't had personal conversations, but just looking at the news, yes. Jameson Greer famously said, Canada shouldn't be moving to China. And because of that, the U.S. was going to impose cut off some relations, which my response is basically, well, of course Canada's doing that because Trump has been pushing Canada toward China. So I thought Jameson Greer's comment was disingenuous.
I mean, there are questions about Canada's role in the Five Eyes. If Canada becomes thoroughly infiltrated by China, would the U.S. want to share intelligence with such a regime? Canada's a net importer of intelligence. So, that's worrying. What about the connection between Canada's communication security establishment, where I was once employed, and the NSA and GCHQ? You know, there are all sorts of implications if Canada is seen as a country that can't keep its information away from Chinese use.
I'm remembering towards the end of the Trudeau government how your intelligence services was releasing information that was embarrassing and challenging to the Prime Minister, and we never had a solution about a rogue element in the intelligence. Wonder what else they know, and wonder what Trudeau did about it.
Yes, we haven't. They've never established who leaked the documents. Considerable number of documents that really called into question how it was that the government had received these intelligence assessments suggesting very serious malign behavior on the part of the Chinese regime in Canada and didn't take any steps to counter it. Now we've got some gestures that have been made with regard to election laws and strengthening security provisions and the proposal of a foreign influence registry. But these appear to be largely performative. And so far, we're not seeing anybody who has been disloyal to Canada with China ending up in prison or being subject to legal procedures. In fact, when they do find a Chinese spy, they haven't been successfully prosecuted because security agencies are not prepared to provide the classified basis for the investigation to the courts. So even if you get caught for say transferring data to the Chinese state, you still aren't made accountable by in a court of law, and led to prison time.
And Mr. Trudeau, last time we talked about him, he was hanging out with the A-listers. Has he moved on to a new profession?
He appears in a Katy Perry video bouncing in the background in some form of dance. So he seems to have a new occupation as background dancer for U.S. failing pop star.
So he is hanging out with A-listers. That's still going on, isn't?
Is that an A-lister? I don't know.
I don't know, Gordon. We're asking.
I regard yourself and Gordon Chang as my A-listers. I'm not sure that I don't have much interest in getting to know. The famous singers of the United States.
There must be another name for them. I'm unaware of these words.
Yeah, I did see a scene where it was shown on the YouTube where Mr. Trudeau and Miss Perry appeared at some event, and all the fans were fawning over Katy Perry, and Trudeau, the former leader of a G7 country, was sort of standing to the side with nothing to do. So I guess that's his new function in life.
Does a former prime minister maintain an office with a staff and a salary and a budget the way a former president does in this country?
No, he doesn't.
So they just cut him loose. You're on your own, pal. Go.
You go into a law firm and, you know, take advantage of decisions you may have made while in a position of trust to enrich yourself seems to be the pattern. I think it's a common pattern for politicians.
Okay. Thank you, Charles, especially for the Gordie Howe Bridge. My goodness, I had no idea.
Yes, I think it. I wonder if Mr. Howe's sons, who are also hockey players, will be at the inaugural ceremony.
Well, in the world of corruption, lordy.
I think something could be done with hockey sticks to open it up. We'll see.
I loved it when you got to the part that they were worried that the tolls would be lower than their tolls. Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about micromanaging.
I mean, you know, you pay a high toll for something with potholes that takes you through 10 traffic lights. You know,
Gordon, if you were writing this up in a thriller, this would be the farce part of the thriller. About,
you know, I've always wondered why at the end of the 401, which is the main road at the southern portion of Canada, it ends up in those traffic lights on the Canadian side in Windsor, and then eventually you get to the Ambassador Bridge. You know, it just struck me as being very strange why the 401 didn't go directly into the Ambassador Bridge.
Well, the part of the answer is that would cut out tolls. Would that make it cheaper, Charles?
Well, it's where the bridge is, and the new bridge will allow for a smooth transition from one highway to the other. I mean, this is 25% of the amount of stuff the U.S. is selling into Canada goes over that bridge. So what Gordon points out with the traffic lights and so on, I mean, it is pretty crazy. But apparently it's a beautiful bridge. I mean, when it was built in 1929, it was the United States' largest steel suspension bridge until the Washington Bridge was built in 1931. It's a beautiful bridge, but it is. It's 100 years old.
Thank you, Charles. You're our bridge reporter. We'll stay with it now that I have heard the backstory. Bridges. It's so complicated. We need a front story to match it.
We'll see what happens next. I don't know how Mr. Trump will take to the prime minister's statement that he was flim-flammed in the negotiations, or whether he'll simply persist in the idea that it was a great triumph for Trump's negotiation skills.
Terrific use of the term flim-flam. Well done, Charles. I think that'll be the only time it shows up on all of radio today. So, well done.
Thank you. Bye.
Gordon, thank you very much, Gordon. Thanks to Lydia as well. The Roman Orchestra is stumbling on the scene saying, you know, it's our turn. Okay, guys. Thank you very much for everybody listening in. See you in 23 hours. Okay, boys and girls.